created, he felt blood on his hands. And so he quit. Today, Lionel spends his winter days on snowshoes, on his trap line, and winter nights preparing furs. Unlike the harsh chemicals of the factory, brain tanning yields the softest, most durable hide. He says with wonder in his voice and a soft moose hide on his lap, there is just enough in each animal's brain to tan its own hide. His own brain and his heart led him back home to the woods. Lionel is of the Métis Nation. He calls himself a blue-eyed Indian, raised in the deep woods of northern Quebec, as his melodious accent suggests. His conversation is so delightfully sauced with oui, oui, madame, that I imagine he will kiss my hand at any moment. His own hands are telling. Woodsman's hands, broad and strong enough to set a trap or a logging chain, but sensitive enough to stroke a pelt to gauge its thickness. By the time we spoke, leg-hold traps had been banned in Canada, and only body-hold traps that ensure a sudden death were permitted. He demonstrates one. It takes two strong arms to open and set, and its powerful snap would break a neck in an instant. Trappers spend more time on the land than anyone else these days, and they maintain detailed records of their harvest. Lionel keeps a thickly penciled notebook in his vest pocket. He takes it out and waves it, saying, "Want to see my new BlackBerry? I just download my data to my bush computer. Runs on propane, don't you know?" His trap lines yield beaver, lynx, coyote, fisher, mink, and ermine. He runs his hand over the pelts, explaining about the density of the winter undercoat and the long guard hairs, how you can judge the health of an animal by its fur. He pauses when it comes to martens, whose pelage is legendary in its silky soft luxury, the American sable. It is beautifully colored and feather light. Martens are part of Lionel's life here. They're his neighbors, and he's thankful that they have rebounded from near extirpation. Trappers like him are on the front line of monitoring wildlife populations and well-being. They have a responsibility to take care of the species they rely upon, and every visit to the trap line produces data that govern the trapper's response. "If we only catch male martens, we'll keep the traps open," he says. When there is an excess of unpaired males, they are wandering and easy to trap. Too many young males can leave less food for the others. But as soon as we get a female, we stop trapping. That means we've skimmed off the excess and we don't touch the rest. That way the population doesn't get too crowded. None will go hungry, but their population will continue to grow. In late winter, when the snow is still heavy, but the days are lengthening, Lionel drags down the ladder from the rafters in his garage. He straps on his snowshoes and stomps out into the bush with the ladder on his shoulder and hammer, nails, and scrap wood in his pack basket. He scouts out just the right spots. Big old trees with cavities are best, as long as the size and shape of the hole dictates that only a single species can use it. He climbs to where the ladder, anchored in the snow, leans against a high branch, and he constructs a platform. He makes it home before dark and rises the next day to do it again. It's hard work lugging a ladder through the woods. When he's done with the platforms, he pulls a white plastic pail from the freezer and sets it by the wood stove to thaw. All summer long, Lionel serves as a fishing guide on the remote lakes and rivers of his birth. He jokes that he works for only himself now, and he calls his company "See More and Do Less." Not a bad business plan. When he and his sports clean their catch, he scrapes the guts into big white pails and keeps them in his freezer. He overheard his clients whispering, "Must be he eats fish gut stew in the winter." The next day, he's off again, pulling the bucket on a sled miles down the trap line. At every platform tree, he scrambles up the ladder with somewhat less grace than a weasel, one-handed. You don't want to slop fish guts all over yourself. He shovels out a big, smelly scoop onto each platform and then hikes off to the next. Like many predators, martens are slow reproducers, which makes them vulnerable to decline, especially when they're exploited. Gestation is about 9 months, and they don't give birth until they're 3 years old. They'll have from 1 to 4 young and raise only as many as the food supply allows. I put out the gut piles in the last weeks before the little mothers give birth, Lionel says. If you put them where nothing else can get them, those mothers will have some extra good meals. That will help them to nurse their babies so more will survive, especially if we get a late snow or something. The tenderness in his voice makes me think of a neighbor delivering a warm casserole to a shut-in. It's not how I thought of trappers. Well, he says, blushing a little, those little martens take care of me, and I take care of them. The teachings tell us that a harvest is made honorable by what you give in return for what you take. There is no escaping the fact that Lionel's care will result in more martens on his trapline. There is no escaping the fact that they will also be killed. Feeding Mama Martens is not altruism. It's deep respect for the way the world works, for the connections between us, of life flowing into life. The more he gives, the more he can take, and he goes the extra mile to give more than he takes. I'm moved by Lionel's affection and respect for these animals, for the care that flows from his intimate knowledge of their needs. He lives the tension of loving his prey and resolves it for himself by practicing the tenets of the honorable harvest. But there is also no escaping the fact that the marten pelts are likely to become a luxury coat for a very wealthy person, perhaps the owner of the Sudbury mine. These animals will die by his hand, but first they will live well, in part, by his hand. His lifestyle, which I had condemned without understanding, protects the forest, protects the lake and rivers, not just for him and the fur bearers, but for all the forest beings. A harvest is made honorable when it sustains the giver as well as the taker. And today Lionel is also a gifted teacher, invited to schools far and wide to share his traditional knowledge of wildlife and conservation. He's giving back what was given to him. It's hard for the guy wearing the sable in the corner office of Sudbury to imagine Lionel's world, to even conceive of a way of living that would require him to consider taking only what he needs, to give back in reciprocity for what he takes, to nurture the world that nurtures him, to carry meals to a nursing mother in a wild treetop den. But unless we want more wastelands, he needs to learn. These may seem like charming anachronisms, rules for hunting and gathering whose relevance vanished along with the buffalo. But remember that the buffalo are not extinct, and in fact are making a resurgence under the care of those who remember. The canon of the honorable harvest is poised to make its comeback too, as people remember that what's good for the land is also good for the people. We need acts of restoration, not only for polluted waters and degraded lands, but also for our relationship to the world. We need to restore honor to the way that we live, so that when we walk through the world, we don't have to avert our eyes with shame, so that we can hold our heads up high and receive the respectful acknowledgement of the rest of the earth's beings. I feel lucky to have wild leeks, dandelion greens, marsh marigolds, and hickory nuts, if I get there before the squirrels do. But these are decorations on a diet that comes mostly from my garden and from the grocery store, like everyone else, especially now that more people live in urban centers than the countryside. Cities are like the mitochondria in our animal cells. They are consumers, fed by the autotrophs, the photosynthesis of a distant green landscape. We could lament that urban dwellers have little means of exercising direct reciprocity with the land. Yet while city folks may be separated from the sources of what they consume, they can exercise reciprocity through how they spend their money. While the digging of the leaks and the digging of the coal may be too far removed to see, we consumers have a potent tool of reciprocity right in our pockets. We can use our dollars as the indirect currency of reciprocity. Perhaps we can think of the honorable harvest as a mirror by which we judge our purchases. What do we see in the mirror? A purchase worthy of the lives consumed? Dollars become a surrogate, a proxy for the harvester with hands in the earth, and they can be used in support of the honorable harvest. Or not. It's easy to make this argument, and I believe that the principles of the honorable harvest have great resonance in an era when overconsumption threatens every dimension of our well-being. But it can be too easy to shift the burden of responsibility to the coal company or the land developers. What about me, the one who buys what they sell, who is complicit in the dishonorable harvest? I live in the country where I grow a big garden, get eggs from my neighbor's farm, buy apples from the next valley over, pick berries and greens from my few rewilding acres. A lot of what I own is secondhand or third. The desk that I'm writing on was once a fine dining table that someone set out on the curb. But while I heat with wood, compost, and recycle, and do myriad other responsible things, if I did an honest inventory of my household, most of it would probably not make the grade of the honorable harvest. I want to do the experiment to see if one can subsist in this market economy and still practice the rules of the honorable harvest. So I take my shopping list and go forth. Actually, our local grocery store makes it pretty easy to be mindful of the choices and the mantra of mutual benefit for land and people. They've partnered with farmers for local organic goods at a price normal people can afford. They're big on green and recycled products, too, so I can hold my toilet paper purchase up to the mirror of the honorable harvest without flinching. When I walk the aisles with open eyes, the source of the food is mostly evident, although Cheetos and Ding Dongs remain an ecological mystery. For the most part, I can use dollars as the currency of good ecological choices, alongside my questionable but persistent need for chocolate. I don't have much patience with food proselytizers who refuse all but organic, free-range, fair-trade gerbil milk. We each do what we can. The honorable harvest is as much about the relationships as about the materials. A friend of mine says she buys just one green item a week. It's all she can do. So she does it. I want to vote with my dollar, she says. I can make choices because I have the disposable income to choose green over less expensive goods, and I hope that will drive the market in the right direction. In the food deserts of the South Side, there is no such choice, and the dishonor in that inequity runs far deeper than the food supply. I am stopped in my tracks in the produce section. There, on a styrofoam tray, sheathed in plastic, and tagged at the princely sum of $15.50 per pound, are wild leeks. The plastic presses down on them. They look trapped and suffocated. Alarm bells go off in my head, alarms of commoditization of what should be regarded as a gift, and all the dangers that follow from that kind of thinking. Selling leeks makes them into mere objects and cheapens them, even at $15.50 per pound. Wild things should not be for sale. Next stop is the mall, a place I try to avoid at all costs, but today I will go into the belly of the beast in service to my experiment. I sit in the car for a few minutes, trying to rouse the same attunement and outlook with which I go to the woods, receptive, observant, and grateful. But I'll be gathering a new stock of paper and pens instead of wild leeks. There's a stone wall across here, too. The three-story edifice of the mall, bordered by another lifeless field of parking lot, with crows perched on the stanchions. As I cross the wall, the floor is hard beneath my feet, and heels click on the faux marble tile. I pause to take in the sounds. Inside, there are neither crows nor wood thrushes, but rather a soundtrack of strangely sanitized oldies set to strings, hovering above the drone of the ventilation system. The light is dim fluorescent, with spotlights to dapple the floor, the better to highlight the splashes of color which identify the shops, their logos as readily identifiable as patches of bloodroot across the forest. Like in the spring woods, the air is a patchwork of scents that I walk among. Coffee here, cinnamon buns there, a shop of scented candles, and beneath it all, the pervasive tang of fast food Chinese from the food court. At the end of the wing, I spy the habitat of my quarry. I navigate easily, as I've been coming here for years, for my traditional harvest of writing supplies. At the store entrance is a stack of bright red plastic shopping bins with metal handles. I pick one up and again become the woman with the basket. In the paper aisle, I'm confronted with a great diversity of species of paper. Wide-ruled and narrow, copier paper, stationery, spiral-bound, loose-leaf, arrayed in clonal patches by brand and purpose. I see just what I want, my favorite legal pads, as yellow as a downy violet. I stand before them, trying to conjure the gathering mentality to bring all the rules of the honorable harvest to bear. But I can't do it without the bite of mockery. I try to sense the trees in that stack of paper and address my thoughts to them, but the taking of their lives is so far removed from this shelf that there is just a distant echo. I think about the harvesting method. Were they clear-cut? I think about the stink of the paper mill, the effluent, the dioxin. Fortunately, there is a stack labeled recycled, so I choose those, paying a little more for the privilege. I pause and consider whether the yellow dyed may be worse than the white bleached. I have my suspicions, but I choose the yellow as I always do. It looks so nice with green or purple ink, like a garden. I wander next to the pen aisle, or as they call it, writing instruments. The choices here are even more numerous, and I have no idea at all where they came from, except some petrochemical synthesis. How can I bring honor to this purchase? Use my dollars as the currency of honor when the lives behind the product are invisible? I stand there so long that an associate comes to ask if I'm looking for anything in particular. I guess I look like a shoplifter planning a heist of writing instruments with my little red basket. I'd like to ask him, where did these things come from? What are they made of? And which one was made with a technology that inflicts minimal damage on the earth? Can I buy pens with the same mentality with which a person digs wild leeks? But I suspect he would call security on the little earpiece attached to his jaunty store cap, so I just choose my favorite for the feel of the nib against the paper and the purple and green ink. At the checkout, I engage in reciprocity, tendering my credit card in return for writing supplies. Both the clerk and I say thank you, but not to the trees. I'm trying hard to make this work, but what I feel in the woods, the pulsing animacy, is simply not here. I realize why the tenets of reciprocity don't work here, while this glittering labyrinth seems to make a mockery of the honorable harvest. It's so obvious, but I didn't see it, So intent was I on searching for the lives behind the products. I couldn't find them because the lives aren't here. Everything for sale here is dead. I get a cup of coffee and sit on a bench to watch the scene unfold, gathering evidence as best I can, notebook open in my lap. Sullen teenagers wanting to buy their selfhood, and sad-looking old men sitting alone at the food court. Even the plants are plastic. I've never been shopping like this before, with such intentional awareness of what goes on here. I suppose I've blocked it out in my usual hurry to get in, make my purchase, and get out. But now I scan the landscape with all senses heightened, open to the t-shirts, the plastic earrings, and the iPods, open to shoes that hurt, delusions that hurt, and mountains of needless stuff that hurts the chances that my grandchildren will have a good green earth to care for. It hurts me even to bring the ideas of the Honorable Harvest here. I feel protective of them. I want to cup them like a small, warm animal in my hands and shelter them from the onslaught of their antithesis. But I know they are stronger than this. It's not the Honorable Harvest that is the aberration, though. It is this marketplace. As leeks cannot survive in a cut-over forest, the Honorable Harvest cannot survive in this habitat. We have constructed an artifice, a Potemkin village of an ecosystem, where we perpetrate the illusion that the things we consume have just fallen off the back of Santa's sleigh, not been ripped from the earth. The illusion enables us to imagine that the only choices we have are between brands. Back home, I wash away the last bits of black soil and trim the long white roots. One big handful of leeks we set aside, unwashed. The girls chop the slender bulbs and the leaves, and they all go into my favorite cast iron skillet with way more butter than a person should probably have. The aroma of sautéed leeks fills the kitchen. Just breathing it in is good medicine. The sharp pungency dissipates quickly, and the fragrance that lingers is deep and savory with a hint of leaf mold and rainwater. Potato leek soup, wild leek risotto, or just a bowl of leeks are nourishment for body and soul. When my daughters leave on Sunday, I'm happy to know that something of their childhood woods will travel with them. After dinner, I take the basket of unwashed leeks to the tiny patch of forest above my pond to plant them. The harvesting process now unfolds in reverse. I ask permission to bring them here, to open the earth for their arrival. I search out the rich, moist hollows and tuck them into the soil, emptying my basket instead of filling it. These woods are second or third growth and sadly lost their leeks long ago. It turns out that when forests around here grow back after agricultural clearing, the trees come back readily, but the understory plants do not. From a distance, the new post-agricultural woods look healthy. The trees came back thick and strong, but inside something is missing. The April showers do not bring May flowers. No trillium, no mayapple, no bloodroot. Even after a century of regrowth, the post-farming forests are impoverished, where the untilled forests just across the wall are an explosion of blossoms. The medicines are missing, for reasons ecologists do not yet understand. It might be microhabitat, it might be dispersal, but it is clear that the original habitat for these old medicines was obliterated in a cascade of unintended consequences as the land was turned to corn. The land is no longer hospitable for the medicines, and we don't know why. The Sky Woman woods across the valley have never been plowed, so they still have their full glory, but most other woods are missing their forest floor. Leek-laden woods have become a rarity. Left to time and chance alone, my cut-over woods would probably never recover their leeks or their trillium. The way I see it, it's up to me to carry them over the wall. Over the years, this replanting on my hillside has yielded small patches of vibrant green in April and nurtures the hope that the leeks can return to their homelands, and that when I'm an old lady, I'll have a celebratory spring supper close at hand. They give to me, I give to them. Reciprocity is an investment in abundance for both the eater and the eaten. We need the honorable harvest today. But like the leeks and the marten, it is an endangered species that arose in another landscape, another time, from a legacy of traditional knowledge. That ethic of reciprocity was cleared away along with the forests. The beauty of justice traded away for more stuff. We've created a cultural and economic landscape that is hospitable to the growth of neither leeks nor honor. If the earth is nothing more than inanimate matter, if lives are nothing more than commodities, then the way of the honorable harvest, too, is dead. But when you stand in the stirring spring woods, you know otherwise. It is an animate earth that we hear calling to us to feed the martens and kiss the rice. Wild leeks and wild ideas are in jeopardy. We have to transplant them both and nurture their return to the lands of their birth. We have to carry them across the wall, restoring the honorable harvest, bringing back the medicine. Braiding sweetgrass. Sweetgrass, as the hair of Mother Earth, is traditionally braided to show loving care for her well-being. Braids, plaited of three strands, are given away as signs of kindness and gratitude. In the footsteps of Nana Bojo, becoming indigenous to place. Fog shrouds the land. There's just this rock in the half-darkness and the surf, rising and falling with a thunderous roar, reminding me of how tenuous my perch is on this tiny island. I almost feel her feet on this cold, wet rocks instead of my own. Sky woman on a speck of land, alone in a cold, dark sea, before she made our home. When she fell from Sky World, Turtle Island was her Plymouth Rock, her Ellis Island. The mother of the people was first an immigrant. I'm new here, too, on this shore at the western edge of the continent. New to how land appears and disappears in this place with the tides and with the fog. No one knows my name here, and I don't know theirs. Without this exchange of the barest recognition, I feel like I could disappear in the fog along with everything else. It is said that the Creator gathered together the four sacred elements and breathed life into them to give form to original man before setting him upon Turtle Island. The last of all beings to be created, first man was given the name Nana Bojo. The Creator called out the name to the four directions so that the others would know who was coming. Nana Bojo, part man, part Monado, a powerful spirit being, is the personification of life forces, the Anishinaabe culture hero, and our great teacher in how to be human. In Nana Bojo's form as original man, and in our own, we humans are the newest arrivals on Earth, the youngsters, just learning to find our way. I can imagine how it might have been for him in the beginning, before anyone knew him, and he did not know them. I too was a stranger at first in this dark, dripping forest, perched at the edge of the sea, but I sought out an elder, my Sitka spruce grandmother, with a lap wide enough for many grandchildren. I introduced myself, told her my name and why I had come. I offered her tobacco from my pouch and asked if I might visit her community for a time. She asked me to sit down, and there was a place right between her roots. Her canopy towers above the forest, and her swaying foliage is constantly murmuring to her neighbors. I know she'll eventually pass the word, and my name, on the wind. Nana Bojo did not know his parentage or his origins. only that he was set down into a fully peopled world of plants and animals, winds and water. He was an immigrant, too. Before he arrived, the world was all here, in balance and harmony, each one fulfilling their purpose in the creation. He understood, as some did not, that this was not the new world, but one that was ancient before he came. The ground where I sit with Sitka grandmother is deep with needles, soft with centuries of humus. The trees are so old that my lifetime compared to theirs is just a bird song long. I suspect that Nana Bojo walked like I do, in awe, looking up into the trees so often I stumble. The Creator gave Nana Bojo some tasks in his role as original man, his original instructions. Anishinaabe elder Eddie Benton Benai beautifully retells the story of Nana Bojo's first work, to walk through the world that Sky Woman had danced into life. His instructions were to walk in such a way that each step is a greeting to Mother Earth. But he wasn't quite sure yet what that meant. Fortunately, although his were first man's prints upon the earth, there were many paths to follow, made by all those whose home this already was. The time when the original instructions were given, we might call a long time ago. For in the popular way of thinking, history draws a time line, as if time marched in lockstep in only one direction. Some people say that time is a river into which we can step but once, as it flows in a straight path to the sea. But Nana Bojo's people know time as a circle. Time is not a river running inexorably to the sea, but the sea itself. Its tides that appear and disappear, the fog that rises to become rain in a different river. All things that were will come again. In the way of linear time, you might hear Nana Bojo's stories as mythic lore of history, a recounting of the long-ago past and how things came to be. But in circular time, these stories are both history and prophecy, stories for a time yet to come. If time is a turning circle, there is a place where history and prophecy converge. The footprints of first man lie on the path behind us and on the path ahead. With all the power and all the failings of a human being, Nana Bojo did his best with the original instructions and tried to become native to his new home. His legacy is that we are still trying. But the instructions have gotten tattered along the way, and many have been forgotten. After all these generations since Columbus, some of the wisest native elders still puzzle over the people who came to our shores. They look at the toll on the land and say, the problem with these new people is that they don't have both feet on the shore. One is still on the boat. They don't seem to know whether they're staying or not. This same observation is heard from some contemporary scholars who see in the social pathologies and relentlessly materialist culture the fruit of homelessness, a rootless past. America has been called the home of second chances. For the sake of the peoples and the land, the urgent work of the second man may be to set aside the ways of the colonist and become indigenous to place. But can Americans, as a nation of immigrants, learn to live here as if we were staying, with both feet on the shore? What happens when we truly become native to a place? When we finally make a home, where are the stories that lead the way? If time does in fact eddy back on itself, maybe the journey of the first man will provide footsteps to guide the journey of the second. Nana Bojo's story first took him toward the rising sun, to the place where the day begins. As he walked, he worried how he would eat, especially as he was already hungry. How would he find his way? He considered the original instructions and understood that all the knowledge he needed in order to live was present in the land. His role was not to control or change the world as a human, but to learn from the world how to be a human. Wabanong, the East, is the direction of knowledge. We send gratitude to the East for the chance to learn every day, to start anew. In the East, Nana Bojo received the lesson that Mother Earth is our wisest teacher. He came to know Sema, the sacred tobacco, and how to use it to carry his thoughts to the Creator. As he continued exploring the land, Nana Bojo was given a new responsibility, to learn the names of all beings. He watched them carefully to see how they lived and spoke with them to learn what gifts they carried in order to discern their true names. Right away he began to feel more at home and was not lonely anymore when he could call the others by name, and they called out to him when he passed, "Bonjour!" Still our greeting to one another today. Today, far from my neighbors in Maple Nation, I see some species I recognize and many I do not. So I walk as original man may have done, seeing them for the first time. I try to turn off my science mind and name them with a Nana Bojo mind. I've noticed that once some folks attach a scientific label to a being, they stop exploring who it is. But with newly created names, I keep looking even closer to see if I've got it right. And so today, it's not Picea sitchensis, but strong arms covered in moss. Branch like a wing instead of Thuya placata. Most people don't know the names of these relatives. In fact, they hardly even see them. Names are the way we humans build relationship, not only with each other, but with the living world. I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to go through life not knowing the names of the plants and animals around you. Given who I am and what I do, I can't know what that's like. But I think it would be a little scary and disorienting, like being lost in a foreign city where you can't read the street signs. Philosophers call this state of isolation and disconnection species loneliness, a deep, unnamed sadness stemming from estrangement from the rest of creation, from the loss of relationship. As our human dominance of the world has grown, we have become more isolated, more lonely, when we can no longer call out to our neighbors. It's no wonder that naming was the first job the Creator gave Nana Bojo. He walked the land handing out names to all he met, and Anishinaabe Linnaeus. I like to think of the two of them walking together. Linnaeus, the Swedish botanist and zoologist, in his loden jacket and woolen trousers, with felt hat cocked back on his forehead and a vasculum under his arm. And Nana Bojo, naked but for his breechcloth and a single feather, with a buckskin bag under his arm. They stroll along discussing the names for things. They're both so enthusiastic, pointing out the beautiful leaf shapes, the incomparable flowers. Linnaeus explains in his Systema Naturae, a scheme designed to show the ways in which all things are related. Nana Bojo nods enthusiastically. "Yes, that is also our way. We say we are all related." He explains that there was a time when all beings spoke the same language and could understand one another, so all of creation knew each other's names. Linnaeus looks wistful about that. "I ended up having to translate everything into Latin," he says, "of binomial nomenclature. We lost any other common language long ago." Linnaeus lends Nana Bojo his magnifying glass so he can see the tiny floral parts. Nana Bojo gives Linnaeus a song so he can see their spirits. And neither of them are lonely. After his eastern sojourn, Nana Bojo's footsteps took him next to the south, Zhaoanong, the land of birth and growth. From the south comes the green that covers the world in spring, carried on the warm winds. There, cedar, kijik, the sacred plant of the south, shared her teachings with him. Her branches are medicine that purify and protect life within her embrace. He carried kijik with him to remind him that to be indigenous is to protect life on earth. Following the original instructions, Benton Banai recounts that Nana Bojo also had the task to learn how to live from his elder brothers and sisters. When he needed food, he noticed what the animals were eating and copied them. Heron taught him to gather wild rice. One night by the creek, he saw a little ring-tailed animal carefully washing his food with delicate hands. He thought, "Ah, I am supposed to put only clean food in my body." Nana Bojo was counseled by many plants, too, who shared gifts and learned to treat them always with the greatest respect. After all, plants were here first on the earth and have had a long time to figure things out. Together, all the beings, both plants and animals, taught him what he needed to know. The Creator had told him it would be this way. His elder brothers and sisters also inspired Nana Bojo to make new things in order to survive. Beaver showed him how to make an axe. Whale gave him the shape for his canoe. He'd been instructed that if he could combine the lessons from nature with the strength of his own good mind, he could discover new things that would be useful for the people to come. In his mind, Grandmother Spider's web became a fishnet. He followed the winter lessons of squirrels to create maple sugar. The lessons Nana Bojo learned are the mythic roots of native science, medicine, architecture, agriculture, and ecological knowledge. But true to the circle of time, science and technology are starting to catch up with native science by adopting the Nana Bojo approach, looking to nature for models of design by the architects of biomimicry. By honoring the knowledge in the land and caring for its keepers, we start to become indigenous to place. To each of the four directions, Nana Bojo wandered on long, strong legs. Singing loudly as he went, he didn't hear the birds' chirps of caution, and was duly surprised when Grizzly challenged him. After that, when he came near the territories of others, he didn't just blunder in as if the whole world belonged to him. He learned to sit quietly at the edge of the woods and wait to be invited. Then, Benton Banai recounts, Nana Bojo would rise and speak these words to the citizens of that place. "I wish not to mar the beauty of the earth or to disturb my brother's purpose. I ask that I be allowed to pass." He saw flowers blooming in the snow, ravens who spoke to wolves, and insects who lit the prairie nights. His gratitude for their abilities grew, and he came to understand that to carry a gift is also to carry a responsibility. The Creator gave Wood Thrush the gift of a beautiful song, with the duty to sing the forest good night. Late at night, he was grateful that the stars were sparkling to guide his way. Breathing underwater, flying to the ends of the earth and back, digging earthen dens, making medicines, every being with a gift, every being with a responsibility. He considered his own empty hands. He had to rely on the world to take care of him. From my high bluff on the coast, I look east, and the hills before me are a ragged range of clear-cut forests. To the south, I see an estuary dammed and diked so that salmon may no longer pass. On the western horizon, a bottom-dragging trawler scrapes up the ocean floor. And far away, to the north, the earth is torn open for oil. Had the new people learned what original man was taught at a council of animals, never damage creation, and never interfere with the sacred purpose of another being, the eagle would look down on a different world. The salmon would be crowding up the rivers, and passenger pigeons would darken the sky. Wolves, cranes, Nehalem, cougars, Lenape, old-growth forests, would still be here, each fulfilling their sacred purpose. I would be speaking Potawatomi. We would see what Nana Bojo saw. It does not bear too much imagining, for in that direction lies heartbreak. Against the backdrop of that history, an invitation to settler society, to become indigenous to place, feels like a free ticket to a housebreaking party. It could be read as an open invitation to take what little is left. Can settlers be trusted to follow Nana Bojo? To walk so that each step is a greeting to Mother Earth? Grief and fear still sit in the shadows, behind the glimmer of hope. And together, they try to hold my heart closed. But I need to remember that the grief is the settlers as well. They too will never walk in a tall grass prairie where sunflowers dance with goldfinches. Their children have also lost the chance to sing at the maple dance. They can't drink the water either. In his journey to the north, Nana Bojo found the medicine teachers. They gave him Wingashk to teach him the ways of compassion, kindness, and healing, even for those who have made bad mistakes, for who has not. To become indigenous is to grow the circle of healing to include all of creation. Sweetgrass, in a long braid, offers protection to a traveler, and Nana Bojo puts some in his bag. A path scented with sweetgrass leads to a landscape of forgiveness and healing for all who need it. She doesn't give her gift only to some. When Nana Bojo came to the West, he found many things that frightened him. The earth shook beneath his feet. He saw great fires consume the land. Sage Mushkodewashk, the sacred plant of the West, was there to help him, to wash away fear. Benton Benai reminds us that Firekeeper himself came to Nana Bojo. "This is the same fire that warms your lodge," he said. "All powers have two sides, the power to create and the power to destroy. We must recognize them both, but invest our gifts on the side of creation." Nana Bojo learned that in the duality of all things, he had a twin brother who was as committed to making imbalance as Nana Bojo was dedicated to balance. That twin had learned the interplay of creation and destruction, and rocked it like a boat on a choppy sea to keep people out of balance. He found that the arrogance of power could be used to unleash unlimited growth, an unrestrained, cancerous sort of creation that would lead to destruction. Nana Bojo vowed to walk with humility in order to try to balance his twin's arrogance. That, too, is the task of those who would walk in his footsteps. I go to sit with my Sitka spruce grandmother to think. I am not from here, just a stranger who comes with gratitude and respect and questions of how it is we come to belong to a place. And yet she makes me welcome, just as we are told the big trees of the West kindly looked after Nana Bojo. Even as I sit in her still shadow, my thoughts are all tangled. Like my elders before me, I want to envision a way that an immigrant society could become indigenous to place, but I'm stumbling on the words. Immigrants cannot, by definition, be indigenous. Indigenous is a birthright word. No amount of time or caring changes history or substitutes for the soul deep fusion with the land. Following Nana Bojo's footsteps doesn't guarantee transformation of second man to first. But if people do not feel indigenous, can they nevertheless enter into the deep reciprocity that renews the world? Is this something that can be learned? Where are the teachers? I'm remembering the words of Elder Henry Lickers. You know, they came here thinking they'd get rich by working on the land, so they dug their mines and cut down the trees. But the land is the one with the power. While they were working on the land was working on them, teaching them. I sit a long time, and eventually the sound of the wind in Grandmother Sitka's branches washes words away, and I lose myself in just listening to the crisp voice of laurels, the chatter of alders, the whispers of lichens. I have to be reminded, just like Nana Bojo, that the plants are our oldest teachers. I get up from my needle-soft nook between grandmother's roots and walk back to the trail, where I am stopped in my tracks. Bedazzled by my new neighbors, giant firs, sword fern, and salal, I had passed by an old friend without recognition. I'm embarrassed to not have greeted him before. From the East Coast to the edge of the West, he had walked here. Our people have a name for this round-leaf plant, white man's footstep. Just a low circle of leaves, pressed close to the ground, with no stem to speak of, it arrived with the first settlers and followed them everywhere they went. It trotted along paths through the woods, along wagon roads and railroads, like a faithful dog so as to be near them. Linnaeus called it Plantago Major, the common plantain. Its Latin epithet, plantago, refers to the sole of a foot. At first, the native people were distrustful of a plant that came with so much trouble trailing behind. But Nana Bojo's people know that all things have a purpose, and that we must not interfere with its fulfillment. When it became clear that white man's footstep would be staying on Turtle Island, they began to learn about its gifts. In spring, it makes a good pot of greens, before summer heat turns the leaves tough. The people became glad for its constant presence when they learned that the leaves, when they are rolled or chewed to a poultice, make a fine first aid for cuts, burns, and especially insect bites. Every part of the plant is useful. Those tiny seeds are good medicine for digestion. The leaves can halt bleeding right away and heal wounds without infection. This wise and generous plant, faithfully following the people, became an honored member of the plant community. It's a foreigner, an immigrant, but after 500 years of living as a good neighbor, people forget that kind of thing. Our immigrant plant teachers offer a lot of different models for how not to make themselves welcome on a new continent. Garlic mustard poisons the soil so that native species will die. Tamarisk uses up all the water. Foreign invaders like loosestrife, kudzu, and cheatgrass have the colonizing habit of taking over others' homes and growing without regard to limits. But plantain's not like that. Its strategy was to be useful, to fit into small places, to coexist with others around the dooryard, to heal wounds. Plantain is so prevalent, so well integrated, that we think of it as native. It has earned the name bestowed by botanists for plants that have become our own. Plantain is not indigenous, but naturalized. This is the same term we use for foreign-born when they become citizens in our country. They pledge to uphold the laws of the state. They might well uphold Nana Bojo's original instructions, too. Maybe the task assigned to Second Man is to unlearn the model of kudzu and follow the teachings of white man's footstep, to strive to become naturalized to place, to throw off the mindset of the immigrant. Being naturalized to place means to live as if this is the land that feeds you, as if these are the streams from which you drink, that build your body and fill your spirit. To become naturalized is to know that your ancestors lie in this ground. Here you will give your gifts and meet your responsibilities. To become naturalized is to live as if your children's future matters, to take care of the land as if our lives and the lives of all our relatives depend on it. Because they do. As time circles around on itself again, maybe White Man's footstep is following in Nanobojo's. Perhaps plantain will line the homeward path. We could follow. White Man's footstep, generous and healing, grows with its leaves so close to the ground that each step is a greeting to Mother Earth. The sound of silver bells. I'd never wanted to live in the South, but when my husband's job took us there, I duly learned the flora and tried to cultivate affection for the drab oaks when I longed for fiery maples. Even if I did not feel fully at home, the least I could do was help my students develop a sense of botanical belonging. In pursuit of this humble goal, I had taken my pre-med students to a local nature reserve where the forest marched up the slope in bands of color, signifying ribbons of different species from the floodplain to the ridge. I asked them to invent a hypothesis or two to explain why the striking pattern existed. "It's all part of God's plan," said one student. "You know, the grand design." After 10 years of immersion in the primacy of materialist science as the explanation for the function of the world, I had to swallow hard. Where I'm from, an answer like that would have drawn laughter, or at least rolled eyes. But in this group, it simply yielded nods of assent, or at the least, tolerance. "That's an important perspective," I said carefully. "But scientists have a different explanation for the distribution of vegetation over the landscape. Maples in one place and spruce in another." This was a dance I was trying to get used to, teaching in the Bible Belt. I stumbled over 2 very left feet. "Have you ever wondered how the world got to be put together so beautifully? Why certain plants grow here and not there?" Judging by their polite blankness, this was not a burning question for them. Their total disinterest in ecology pained me. To me, ecological insight was the music of the spheres, but to them it was just one more requirement in their pre-med education. A biological story that wasn't about humans was of little interest. I didn't understand how one could be a biologist without being able to see the land, to know natural history and the elegant flow of natural forces. The earth is so richly endowed that the least we can do in return is to pay attention. And so with a little evangelical fervor of my own, I set my sights on the conversion of their scientific souls. All eyes were on me, waiting for failure. So I paid attention to every little detail, just to prove them wrong. Vans idled in the circle in front of the administration building while I checked my list one more time. Maps prepared, campsites reserved, 18 pairs of binoculars, 6 field microscopes, 3 days of food, first aid kits, and reams of handouts of graphs and scientific names. The dean argued that it was too expensive to take students into the field. I argued that it was too costly not to. Whether the passengers were willing or not, our little convoy of college vans was headed down the highway through the sheared-off mountaintops of coal country, where the streams run red with acid. Shouldn't students devoted to a profession in health see this firsthand? The hours on a dark highway gave me plenty of time to consider the wisdom of trying the dean's patience in my very first job. The college was already struggling with finances, and I was just a part-time instructor, teaching a few classes while I finished my dissertation. I'd left my baby girls at home with their dad in order to introduce other people's children to something they cared little about. This exclusive little college had built its reputation in the South on the successful admission of its students to medical school. Accordingly, the sons and daughters of the bluegrass aristocracy were sent here for their first step toward lives of privilege. In keeping with this medical mission, The dean ritually donned a white coat every morning, as a priest dons his vestments. His desk calendar called only for administrative meetings, budget reviews, and alumni functions. But the lab coat was a fixture. Though I never saw him in an actual lab, it was no wonder that he harbored doubts about a flannel shirt scientist like me. The biologist Paul Ehrlich called ecology the subversive science, for its power to cause us to reconsider the place of humans in the natural world. So far, these students had devoted several years to the study of a single species, themselves. I had a whole 3 days to be subversive, to distract them from Homo sapiens, for a glimpse of the 6 million other species with whom we share the planet. The dean voiced his concerns about funding a mere camping trip, but I argued that the Great Smoky Mountains were a major reservoir of biodiversity, and promised that it would be a legitimate scientific expedition. I was tempted to add that we'd wear lab coats for good measure. He sighed and signed the requisition. The composer Aaron Copland got it right. An Appalachian spring is music for dancing. The woods dance with the colors of wildflowers, nodding sprays of white dogwood and the pink froth of redbuds, rushing streams, and the embroidered solemnity of dark mountains. But we were here to work. I got out of my tent the first morning with clipboard in hand and lessons in mind. The range spread out before us in our valley campsite. The Smokies in early spring are a patchwork of diffuse colors, like a map with individual nations colored. Pale green for the newly leafed poplars, gray blocks of the still dormant oaks, and dusty rose for the maples breaking bud. Here and there, hot pink tracts of red bud and swaths of white reveal where the dogwoods bloom, and lines of dark green hemlock trace the watercourses like a cartographer's pen. Back in the classroom, hands white with chalk dust, I had diagrammed the gradients of temperature, soils, and growing season. Before us, the mountainside spread the pastel map of our field trip, the abstract translated into flowers. Moving up the mountainside was the ecological equivalent of walking to Canada. The warm valley floor could give us a Georgia summer, while the 5,000-foot summits are akin to Toronto. "Bring your warm jackets," I told them. An increase of 1,000 feet is equivalent to moving 100 miles northward, and therefore many steps back into spring. The dogwoods on the lower slopes were in full bloom, creamy white sprays against the emerging leaves. Moving upslope, they reversed like a time-lapse camera running backwards from open blossoms to tightly bound buds not yet awakened by heat. Midway up the slope, where the growing season is too short, the dogwoods disappear altogether, their place taken by another tree, more tolerant of the late-season frosts, silver bells. For 3 days we wandered over this ecological map, traversing elevational zones from deep cove forests of tulip poplar and cucumber magnolia to the summits. The lush coves were a garden of wildflowers, glossy patches of wild ginger, and 9 species of trillium. The students dutifully wrote down whatever I told them, creating a mirror image of my internal checklist of things to see, without much apparent interest. They asked for the spelling of scientific names so often that I felt I was in a woodland spelling bee. The dean would be proud. For 3 days, I checked the species and ecosystems off the list to justify the trip. We mapped vegetation, soils, and temperature with the fervor of Alexander von Humboldt. At night, we drew graphs around the campfire. Oak hickory at mid-elevation, coarse gravelly soil, check. Reduced stature and increased wind speed at high elevation, check. Phenological patterns with elevational change, check. Endemic salamanders, niche diversification, check. I so wanted them to see the world beyond the boundaries of their own skins. I was conscientious not to waste a single teaching opportunity and filled the quiet woods with facts and figures. My jaw ached at the end of the day when I crawled into my sleeping bag. This was hard work. When I hike, I like to do it quietly, just looking, just being there. Here I was constantly talking, pointing things out, generating discussion questions in my head, being the teacher. I only lost it once. The road became steeper as we approached the top of the range. The vans labored around sharp switchbacks and were buffeted by strong winds. No more soft maples and pink froth of redbud. At this elevation, the snows had only recently melted away from beneath the firs. Looking out over the land, we could see how narrow this band of boreal forest was, a thin strip of Canadian habitat, way down here in North Carolina, hundreds of miles north from the nearest spruce fir woods, just a remnant from the day when ice covered the north. Today, these high mountaintops offer a refuge that feels like home to spruce and fir, islands in a sea of southern hardwoods, perched high enough to duplicate the Canadian climate. These islands of northern woods felt like home to me, too, and in the fresh, cold air, I slipped the leash of my lectures. We prowled among the trees, breathing in the scent of balsam, the soft mattress of needles, wintergreen, trailing arbutus, bunchberry. All my familiars from home carpeted the forest floor. They made me realize suddenly how displaced I felt to be teaching in someone else's home forest when I was so far from my own. I lay down on a carpet of moss and held class from a spider's perspective. High on these summits lived the world's last population of the endangered spruce fir moss spider. I didn't expect pre-med students to give a damn, but I had